Our sermon text this day is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 to 11. And that is found on page 553 of your Pew Bible. Ecclesiastes 1, 1 to 11. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind. And on its circuits, the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing. The ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to come among those who come after. Well, let's all go home and cry in our beer, shall we? After that. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Huh? How does one escape from this? How does one escape from the endless cycle of time, especially in pagan cosmologies? The pagan philosophies and cosmologies will give you no comfort at all in any of this, will they? Because indeed, they are as cyclical as this text presents reality to be. In Hinduism, that which we call reality is but an illusion, Maya. As one Hindu priest says, a projection of the real, though it is not the real. In Hindi philosophy, a universe endures for about 4,320,000,000 years. That's nothing in comparison with our budget, is it? If every dollar was a year, we'd be 14 trillion. Instead of 4 trillion. And then is destroyed by fire or water in the Hindi scheme of things. This process is repeated again and again forever. The cycle is endless, repeating eternally. There's no escape from the cycle of time. In Buddhism, the universe is pictured as a wheel of life, isn't it? And upon it, life turns in a great circle, as the Buddhist says, spun by resolutions of greed, ignorance, and hatred, unquote. All of what we observe is eternally determined by a blind fate in Buddhism. That which happens now has happened ages ago in the past. That which happened ages ago will occur again in distant ages to come. This very moment in our worship service has recurred eternally and will recur again sometime in the distant 4 billion-year cycle of things. Even the pagan cosmology of modern atheistic science is cyclical, isn't it? There's no way out of it, if indeed you posit creation as eternal. The Big Bang Theory says that from an infinitely small particle of matter, a vacuum flux occurred. This is Isaac Asimov's term, a vacuum flux, a minute fluctuation in the stability of matter, that caused the Big Bang, this minute particle of matter, to explode into the universe that we now know. In time, of course, they predict that all of this matter will contract again into this infinitely tiny speck of matter as it once was and will repeat the cycle over and over again. There are no exceptions. Every cosmology of the world without Christ is cyclical and therefore hopeless. Even the cheap knockoff religions, like the LDS faith, that is cosmic and cyclical, isn't it? There's the cheap knockoff faith of Islam, too, that has copied the Judeo-Christian tradition. All pagan cosmologies fail to account for the infinite personal God of the Bible, as Francis Schaeffer calls him. And that's each word there, the infinite personal God of the Bible, carefully chosen to confront our modern world and these pagan cosmologies. Biblical cosmology is what? It is not cyclical, it's what? Linear. Yes, it is linear. There is a beginning, a middle, and an end. In the beginning, our book begins, right? Starts out with, it has a beginning, a creation from that infinite personal God. When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son into the world, redemptive history unfolding before our eyes. We're somewhere in that middle, are we not? But there will be an end, as we saw in Peter, the letters of Peter. The end of all things is that had, is it not? Biblical cosmology is linear. There is a way out. There is salvation from the endless cycle of life, sin, mere existence, and death. This meaningless repetition of things happening again and again, even as Koheleth has outlined for us. Well, if this is true, what is Ecclesiastes doing in the Bible? He's just introduced that book to us in words of that would resonate with many pagan philosophers. Is there no end to the repetitive cycles? Do they repeat ad infinitum? What are we to conclude regarding ultimate things from this book, Ecclesiastes? We introduced it a couple of weeks ago. Let's look now to our first in-depth text, shall we? Which is here before us. Ecclesiastes 1, 1 to 11. 2 points, broad points I want to make with you this day. Verses 1 through 7. First of all, vapor. That is how I translate this word that is translated vanity in your ESV or in King James, or meaninglessness as the NIV so liberally translates this word, hebel. We're going to stick to its literal translation, though. Vapor is how it is translated literally, vapor. Because that describes precisely what he's getting at here. Vapor, then, point number one. When a man looks at the cyclical nature of the natural world, what is he to conclude? Now, I gave you no substantial answer there, but I gave you a question, right? Why do Jews always answer a question with a question? Why do you ask? You might say. Well, the text before us today forms the introduction to this book of wisdom that we have briefly defined, just to review briefly for you. How have we approached this book? We've kind of summarized its approach as a conundrum, a biblical conundrum, the book is. And we define a conundrum, the Oxford English Dictionary, as a difficult puzzle, the answer to which is based upon a pun, or whose answer is enigmatic. That's very much to the point. We have here before us a wisdom puzzle with none of the answers floating around on the surface. It's a puzzle that we, an enigmatic puzzle, that we have to labor and work at. Labor, and that seems to be one of his themes in here, isn't it? Labor and work. What is the value of toil of man? Well, that's a pun in and of itself, because you are expected to labor and work with great diligence to figure this book out. It is a biblical conundrum, if you will. We have posited as well that Ecclesiastes is a book which Solomon put before his sons. You know all of the wisdom literature, right? It, given for the training of sons. Sons, listen to my voice. Sons, listen to my sons. Listen to the voice of wisdom. Well, Solomon had sons too, didn't he? He lays this book before them who would follow him on the throne of Israel. How would they develop the wisdom requisite to rule the people? How would they grapple with the questions that would be brought to them? You remember, people came from far and wide to Solomon to lay their questions before him, have him, the wisest man in all the earth, answer them. Well, when his son sat in the gate, which is the figurative place of judgment and wisdom in Israel, when his sons then came to sit at the gate, how would they answer these questions wisely? Well, a beginning could be made with this book, though not certainly guaranteed, right? As witnessed by the history of his sons subsequent to Solomon's. Remember, Rehoboam and Jeroboam, right after his death, the kingdom splits. Not very wise. But a beginning could be made by providing a set of questions whose answers are not to be easily lifted from the page before them. Rather, it would require a thorough familiarity with previous wisdom literature, and yea, the entire canon of Scripture, for that matter, as we will see. Plus, an application to the circumstances before each king. They would vary, wouldn't they? So there's no glib and simple answers for every circumstance given in this book, but a book wrestling with which you would develop any wisdom that God had given you, hopefully. Well, it's great. Great for them. What about us, huh? What about us? I like what Fredericks and Estes, their commentary, what they say about this. They say, that is us. One should study Ecclesiastes with the goal of becoming a quote-unquote ruler who employs biblical wisdom. A ruler whose realm is one's own brief life and its needy and passing surroundings. And that's how we come to this book then. We are all kings in our own realm, are we not, in some way, shape, or form? Well, Solomon begins his labors. And he is laboring. He's working as hard over this as he expects you to work over it, and as hard as you work in your daily calling, too. Labor, very much the theme of this book. And he begins his labors with a poem, an elegant poem. This is beautiful Hebrew, by the way. This is very erudite Hebrew. Vapor of vapors, says Koheleth. Vapor of vapors. All is vaporous. Now, you won't find that in your translation, but I'm going to use the literal word that's used here, vapor, that is then extrapolated as a metaphor in other translations. But literally, it is vapor. Vapor of vapors, says Koheleth. Vapor of vapors. All is vaporous. This is one of those key vocabulary words that I highlighted for you in our introduction. Hebel. Hebel. Vapor or breath. This is alliterative, isn't it? Hebel, hebel. You hear how breathy that word is in just in pronouncing it? So I will use it instead of vanity because it more accurately conveys what Solomon intends, that everything is so fleeting, so brief, nothing remains at the end of the day. That's the sense of this vanity or meaninglessness. No, it's vapor. There is an unwise, maybe even a foolish conclusion, which many draw from this that Solomon is not. And that unwise conclusion is that because all is fleeting and vaporous, brief, that therefore all is vain. He's not quite saying that. And therefore, because all is vain, then all is useless and meaningless. Friedrich Nietzsche loved Ecclesiastes for that reason. David Hume, Isaac Asimov, all the recent atheists, Sam Harris, for example, in his book, all love Ecclesiastes because they make it say this, that because all that we accomplish, so much of life, seems so vaporous and transient and fleeting, that therefore it is vain and that therefore it is useless and meaningless too. Solomon, although he may be setting you up to perhaps come to that conclusion, he is not making that conclusion himself, and he does not want you, if you are wise, indeed, but if you are a fool, you will, but if you're wise, you won't, because Solomon does not conclude that. More precisely, Solomon is declaring that what he has observed is that all is fleeting, all is temporary, all is brief. Wisdom will note the inherent frustrations and the grief in the brief, if you will. There is inherent frustrations and grief in the brief, and he will unfold that for us. But wisdom will also take note of the blessings and the benefits of the brief, too. And he will highlight those for us as well. And he will not conclude in the end that all is meaningless and vain. This brevity is even communicated in the Hebrew speech of the speech. And this is a speech, too, by the way. This is an elegant and eloquent speech. And if the ideal thing would be for all of us to know Hebrew, and I could give you this speech in Hebrew, and you would see how eloquent and erudite it was and how moving it is, really. But even the speech of this speech, as I illustrated for you, Hevel Habalim, Hevel Habalim, Hachol Hevel. You see the breathing and the breathiness of this and the fleeting nature of the human breath. That's precisely what he's trying to communicate, even alliteratively, as we speak this speech in Hebrew. Now, Solomon will note the vaporous nature of much of human activity. Pleasure, we'll cover all these things and more. Pleasure, youth, success, how fleeting is wealth, any of you who are in the stock market? How fleeting is desire, even life itself? How fleeting. But what he studiously avoids is leaping to the conclusion of the fool, that all is therefore vain and meaningless. That's the conclusion of the fool, the Nietzsches, the Asimovs, the David Humes of the world. Now, you can still arrive at that same conclusion that we are arriving at by still translating Hevel as vanity or meaninglessness, even as the history of interpretation makes clear to us. But you'll do it with far less cognitive dissonance by treating this word as vapor rather than vanity or meaninglessness. So, we will studiously translate Hevel literally as vapor or breath. Well, and this is of the nature of wisdom literature too. We see in chapter 12, verse 9, that Koheleth weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs, he did, didn't he? He weighed, studied, and arranged many proverbs with great care. We are to do the same and work as hard as he had in composing it by reading it with great care. It is the opposite of the fool. Proverbs says, the fool is reckless and careless. We are not to read the Proverbs with reckless abandon and carelessness. Proverbs being, of course, the companion volume to Ecclesiastes, the direct one. Well, Solomon then poses his thematic rhetorical question. What does man gain? What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Huh? What a coincidence. I was just asking myself that same question the other day, trying to hollow out 15 fence post holes. 24. Ugh! I feel even worse now. We did this. I know you were all over at my house helping me that one day, and you know how much work it was. Well, Deb and I had a reprise of that day on the other side of the house doing 24 fence post holes on a hot, sunny day under the sun. So what a coincidence, huh? What is the use? Huh? Why are we doing this? What's the use? And note our second recurring theme, too, under the sun. I said that I wanted to highlight for you so that you take great care in understanding not only Hevel, that is breath or vapor, but also the idea of what does it mean to be under the sun. Three things I'd like to point out with you. First of all, the vaporous is found in this life. That's one of the things he means by under the sun when he employs that phrase. That is, the vaporous is found in this life. It's synonymous with while under the sun or while alive might be a freer understanding of this. He says, while you're alive, these things are true. So this is the condition, the operative condition under which all of these things take place. The place of our life, in other words, points to its time span. The place of our life points to its time span. Very brief. Secondly, under the sun. The enduring is found above the sun. The enduring is found above the sun. He never uses that phrase, does he? But by implication, if indeed you have at your elbow while you read this book, Proverbs, the other wisdom literature, the rest of the canon, you know, by implication, those things found in heaven are in contrast here and eternal. And he says this in chapter 5, verse 2, for that matter. Thirdly, under the sun. The sun. The sun has a place throughout this book. The sun. The sun blesses and curses. The very same sun. There aren't two different suns in the sky, are there? Well, one for blessing and one for cursing? No, the same sun blesses and curses. It becomes a great metaphor for God's providence, the sun. The sun burnt me and exhausted me while I dug those fence posts. Yet where would I be without it? It warms the earth, it causes our garden to flourish, gives me light by which to provide for myself and my family. And Solomon will note all of these things as well in the course of his speech. So, under the sun. And implicit in the brevity of our labor, too, is the curse, too, right? Can you see the curse lurking underneath all of this speech? Cursed is the ground because of you. In grief you will eat from it. By the sweat of your face you will eat food until you return to the ground. Solomon then contrasts the brevity of all things human with the apparent permanence of all things natural. A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. And the permanence of that earth is illustrated with the circularity of three elements. The circularity of three elements, or in the cyclical nature of these three elements. Number one, the sun labors in setting and rising. Two, the genius of this beautiful, beautiful speech is that you get communicated to you that all three of these elements are laboring as well. The sun labors in setting and rising. Consonant with the theme of hard labor then, the sun labors in its east to west circuit, right? Its east to west circuit. Consonant with the rest of wisdom literature, is it not? From the psalm that we read today. Psalm 19 says, puts it this way, he has set a tent for the sun in the skies. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his bedroom, rejoicing like the virile, ready to run his course. It goes from one end of the skies, following its circuit, to the other end. Surely nothing is hid from its heat. So, consonant with the rest of wisdom literature in the scriptures, the sun labors in setting and rising. Secondly, the winds labor in their blowing, too, don't they? The winds labor in their blowing. While the compass of the earth's latitude is taken up in the rising and setting of the sun, its longitude is compassed in the north-south course of the wind. So we have sketched for us then, and just this brief couple of verses, all of nature, all of creation, east and west, north and south, all the points of the compass. It too, the wind, works hard, but returns whence it began. Thirdly, the waters labor in their flowing too, don't they? The waters labor and work in their flowing. Observationally, Solomon sees with his eyes that though the rivers flow down from the mountains and into the sea ceaselessly, they never run out because clouds drift in from that very same sea, don't they? Labor, labor, work, work. The endless cycle goes on and on, doesn't it? This is the arena, then. He has just sketched for us in these very few brief verses, but done so very eloquently. He has just sketched for us the arena in which we labor. Individual rays of sunlight shine each day. Individual gusts of wind blow each day. Individual drops of water flow each day. But they're all forgotten as the ceaseless course of cycles goes on and on and on. Now, Solomon has made no judgment call yet, has he? He has made no judgment call in terms of its vanity, meaningless, and all of that. No. He will do so as he continues then, as he says in chapter 9, to weigh, study, and arrange with great care. So we should read it with great care as well. Will you be transported to eternity by all of this that occurs under the sun? The artist, the statesman, the general all seek eternity and immortality, do we not? We aspire, poets and authors have written about this, we aspire to eternality, to be remembered by generations hence as we study ourselves in the arts or in pleasure. But such is the way of the fool. Such is the way of the fool. And Solomon will underline that for us as we go along. So do not be transported to eternity. Do not aspire to. Do not put on your wings and attempt to fly to the sun, or you will indeed crash and burn. Will you be dejected then? If you can't be transported to the realms of heaven by all of this under the sun, then will you be dejected to a hellish despair then? Be like the beat poets and existentialism and growl in your coffee in the coffee houses and complain about that. You guys, I see some smiles over here from those of you that were around in the 60s, right? Will you be dejected to a hellish despair like the philosophers and the skeptics and the mental patients of the world, huh? This too, he will say, is the way of the fool, the nabal, the fool. Well then, how are we to respond? What are we to conclude? That brings me to point number two. First of all, vapor. Hebel. Hebel. When a man looks at the cyclical nature of the human condition, what is he to conclude? Well, we just answered the question with another question, didn't we? Sorry. If you thought that nature gets weary with its cycles of labor, how about us? Huh? How about us? How many times will I have to reset my fence posts? One of which is already a little bit washed out after irrigating, after some of the rains. Those fence posts we so studiously set when you guys were out at my property, one of them's already a little shaky. You know, we not only make, but we maintain, don't we? While Solomon sounds as if he spent a week setting fence posts. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. Nice little Hebrew tuner phrase there. It means you can't come to the end of it. You cannot completely, comprehensively articulate just how weary things are. Does he say they're meaningless, though? Does he say they're vain? Now, you may conclude that, but you're a fool if you do. In parallel, then, with the three elements of nature, water, wind, and fire, three human senses are contrasted and compared. First of all, no amount of speech can be uttered so as to endure. No amount of speech in the human condition, no amount of speech can be uttered so as to endure. Who says anything that is final, that endures? Huh? Even the speech, he realizes, will not endure. No one under the sun, right? Although there is a big exception, the 800-pound gorilla in the room is who? It is God's word, right, that it does endure. But we're talking about that which lies under the sun. Secondly, no amount of sight can be seen so as to endure. The eye is never full of seeing, is it? No amount of sight can be seen so as to endure. Western science is empirical, isn't it? That is, conclusions drawn from the observable world of experience, empiricism. Yet when have we seen enough? When have we seen so as to be certain and enduring? Even science changes, right? It is revised over the generations. Thirdly, no amount of hearing can be heard so as to endure. No amount of hearing can be heard so as to endure. That's the sense of that which is vaporous, that which is fleeting. We listen to sermon after sermon, and yet you don't change. Should I just stand here and preach until everybody is transformed and changes? We hear sermon after sermon, speech after speech, instruction after instruction. Those of you that raise children know this, don't you? We grow in understanding and wisdom, yet when have we heard enough that we can say, this will last, this will last under the sun? So, no amount of speech, seeing, or hearing can be experienced so as to establish anything we do as anything more than vapor. Vapor. Like mist on the river in the morning, or a vapor floating upward from a pot on the stove, or seeing your breath on a cold morning. All that we do, including our very existence, our very lives, appears momentarily and then poof, disappears. What are we to do? How are we to respond? Well, here's the short answer. No. I'm not going to give it to you. Koheleth does not relieve our tension just yet, does he? In fact, he deepens the conundrum by paralleling the circularity and brevity of the things of nature with that which is new and remembered in human experience, too. He does. What I also want to do with you and for you is to prepare you to share this with lost men and women in your realm of experience as you labor with them. Is there anything that we've talked about here that is not universal? That is one of the themes of Koheleth as well. That all of this is shared by all men. You can go to work tomorrow, hear people complaining about work, they're doing precisely what he says. Is there anything? Is there anything of value, anything lasting to what I'm doing here in my life? Especially those of you that work for the or that are employed by the government. Is there anything lasting? Is there anything that will endure in your labors? Sometimes things aren't even brought to completion and fruition, are they? How frustrating. How vaporous it seems. Someday John's work with batteries, vaporous. Let it all go away. Someday the things that Brian gives himself to in construction will collapse and fall, decay, and deteriorate. The fountains that John's been working on, someday they'll stop. They get choked up for some reason or another and go the way of all flesh. I'm sure you guys don't want to hear that, maybe perhaps at this particular time, but it's true, isn't it? And everyone you work with, every one of your neighbors shares that same feeling and approach. So, we have, as the church, a great amount of ammunition here in this book, if we take the time to commit ourselves to it. So, Koheleth deepens the conundrum by paralleling then the circularity, the brevity of things of nature with that which is new and remembered in human experience. First of all, he says, there's nothing new under the sun. This is a proverb. This is one of those proverbs that has crept into our culture, right? Funny, did the Bible take this from culture, or did our culture get this from the Bible? There's nothing new under the sun. And as his speech, remember this is a one continuous speech from chapter 1 to chapter 12. And as his speech will unfold for us, the new of which he speaks is the nature and product of his labor. That is he any different a creature at the end of the day? With all his labor and toil. Is he any more righteous, any more moral, any closer to his Creator, any more permanent than before he began his labors? That's what he means by new. Essentially, if we were to meet Koheleth here, if he were to walk down the aisle at this particular time, we would be essentially the same men as he was, as his generation was. The answer comes back then, a resounding no, and it will throughout his speech. That is, if his labor under the sun is all he relies upon for these things. That's the great parentheses. It's an important qualification that he will subtly articulate for us in the course of his speech here, too. If you're relying only on those things that are under the sun, then this indeed is precisely what you will come to. Sure, we have supersonic air travel and cars, trains, and buses that are new. They carry us swiftly to places. But all that these new things do is bring us more swiftly to war, to places of adultery, drunkenness, and corruption. Sure, we have cures for disease that are new. They prolong our lives for a few more vaporous years, as he would put it. But what do we do with them? We spend them doing the same things we did in the earlier years. We hate God, we sin, and generally add to our condemnation for those years by the same pattern of behavior we displayed before. Sure, we have computers and cell phones, Skype. Just talked to my son yesterday on Skype. How great that was. It allows us to talk and communicate almost instantly with one another. Yeah, what is it we communicate? You ever listen to conversations on cell phone going into space? Sometimes a conversation on cell phone goes up into space and right down to your next door neighbor or somebody in the next room. All we talk is the same drivel that we talk about before we had these instruments. Look at the Solyndra emails, for example. Find out what corruption is communicated despite this new technology. So, it's in this sense that Solomon declares there's nothing new under the sun. What you see before you as a man is substantially that which you would have in Koheleth's day. And secondly, nothing will be remembered, right? Nothing will be remembered so as to be enduring, verse 11. Nothing will be remembered so as to be enduring. The idea of remembrance. It's a long and storied theme, isn't it, in the Bible? Who remembers? Who remembers? The biblical idea of remembrance, what is it? In our lexicon, to remember to means to bring back to recollection in the mind, right? And we say, remember that conversation we had the other day? Oh, okay, yeah. I have it present in the frontal lobe of my brain, right? Well, in the scriptures, the biblical understanding is much, much deeper. Let me just give you three different takes on remembrance in the Bible. We found all through Deuteronomy, right, as we read through it. Remember the laws and statutes and commands given you this day. Well, I can remember most of the Ten Commandments most of the time, but that's not what they mean by remembering that I'm able to recite them. No, remember means to do, to act so as to obey in this case, right? We also have in the scriptures, the Lord remembered. How often? The Lord remembered Noah, right? He made the rainbow so that he could remember his covenant. He remembers Lot to save him. He remembers David to save him. And he remembers his covenant with Abraham so as to honor it. That is, God so puts before himself these things that we've articulated, including your soul, puts before him these things so that he acts in faithfulness towards them. Remembrance bears the same freight here. Nothing from the past will be so remembered so as to be done that it will issue in permanence, that it will be acted upon to issue in permanence. Because of this, remembrance, human remembrance, is so vaporous, isn't it? What politician remembers Nebuchadnezzar so as to eschew his hubris or David's humility before God so as to govern wisely? What pastor remembers the greed of Simon Magus so as to eschew it, or Paul's liberality so as to emulate it? What billionaire remembers the parable of the rich fool so as to eschew his behavior, or the parable of the talents that he might follow the example of the ones who use those talents wisely? It's this kind of remembrance, so as to act, so as to do, so as to be, that Koheleth despairs of seeing endure. In the very act of recalling these things, I remembered, didn't I? I remembered all those things I told you about. But that's not what they mean by remembering. They mean remembering so as to act and to do that remains in permanence. All of these are vaporous. And Solomon will deepen our understanding of them in days to come. Why bother? Why bother? Will you conclude in despair that all is vain and meaningless and go away with the existentialists in the coffee house? Or will you be so taken with things under the sun that you will get lost in them? Adopt your wings of wax and feathers. Fly to the sun and crash and burn. He does not lead us to either of these things, Koheleth. As Fredericks and Estes say, Koheleth does not answer these questions immediately, preferring to incite us to the same level of frustration he experienced. So if you expect to come to every sermon seeking to be pleased and to have feelings stroked and feel good when you walk out, not necessarily so with this one. This one was more or less meant to excite you to the same level of frustration as Koheleth, so that you will be wiser at the end of the day. And we, the church, I submit to you, we, the church, we have great opportunity to seize the truths taught here. Because the things you hear here, you will hear tomorrow, won't you? When you go into your workplace, when you talk over the fence with your neighbor, when your kid calls you and says, guess what happened? Right? We're all faced with this, and the church has a great opportunity to point to the land above, the land and the Lord above the sun. So you will not only have opportunity to relish and wisely employ this life under the sun, but also use the very vaporous nature of it to win and attract the lost to the gospel. Because there is indeed, we know, do we not? Because we've been brought alive to that world, and we can now point others to that life above the sun, with the sun. Because there is something enduring, someone enduring. There is something enduring because there is someone enduring. Even as Moses declares, he says, give ear, O heavens, and I will speak. Let the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teachings drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew. Already talking like a wise man, is he not? Like gentle rain upon the tender grass and like showers upon the herb. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord. Ascribe greatness to our God, the rock. That's pretty enduring, is it not? The rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are justice. There is justice. Koheleth will complain about the lack of justice in the world. There is justice in the rock. His work is perfect. A God of faithfulness, he will complain of the faithlessness in the human condition. But there is one who is faithful to save. And without iniquity, Moses says, just and upright is he. Great opportunity. Learn this book. Get it in your bones so that you'll be able to not only resonate with your lost friends, neighbors, and relatives, but also you'll be able to explain it and articulate it, and at least seem wise, right? Seem wise. Go from being a wise guy to a wise man. Brothers and sisters, I call you to it. Come to this enduring one today. Let us now then taste of that permanence. With the vaporous as they may be, the elements